Thanks for downloading our podcast. You can find out more about TechTent from our webpage. Go to bbcworldservice.com/techtent.
Hello and welcome to TechTent, your weekly update on what's going on in the world of technology. I'm Zoe Kleinman, and with me in the tent is the BBC's online tech reporter, Marianne Rousson. Hi, Marianne.
Hello.
And my special guest today is Thomas Tamblyn, the tech editor of HuffPost UK. Tom describes himself on Twitter as a semi-professional rambler for the English language. We have a lot in common, Tom. Welcome back to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Tom will be sharing his expert insights, no pressure, Tom, with us throughout the programme. So here's a taste of what's coming up.
And I tried it out with pears and apples, and it tells you exactly how much water's in it, how many calories, how much sugar. And it's aimed at athletes and people who are on very, very strict diets.
When you think about data generated by the vehicle, that's going to grow exponentially. As autonomous driving develops, there's more and more sensors on the vehicle that generate a lot of data.
But first, let's consider the humble drone. It's easy to think unkindly of them. The short battery life, the pictures they take, the fact that they have a habit of straying close to airports when they shouldn't. Since their launch, if you'll pardon the pun, drones have caused controversy, so much so that here in the UK, the government recently announced plans to introduce drone registration and safety awareness courses for owners. Of course, they do also have professional uses, and they might one day deliver your groceries. But is it in developing countries where their benefits will be felt the most? Last year, we reported on US startup Zipline's plan to distribute blood products in Rwanda using drones. Now the company says it's about to begin similar work in Tanzania, where the BBC's Jane Wakefield has been attending the TED Global Conference this week. She spoke to Zipline's founder, Kella Rinaldo, at the event.
We actually last year launched the only drone delivery service operating at national scale anywhere, and we operate in Rwanda delivering blood to hospitals across the country.
So explain how you do that and how the drone kind of works.
You know, it's a lot simpler than it sounds. We have a distribution center in the middle of the country. We receive blood from the National Center for Blood Transfusion. And then when any doctor or technician at a hospital needs blood products to treat a patient, they can essentially send us a WhatsApp or place an order online. We get that order immediately. We pack the blood, load it onto an autonomous electric vehicle that looks a little bit like an airplane. And then we launch it, and it arrives in an average of 20 or 30 minutes.
This isn't a free service, is it? So how do you work out how to charge for it?
I mean, one of the most important things that we're trying to show is that it's possible to tackle these problems in entrepreneurial ways. It doesn't just have to be NGOs and foreign aid that is working on these big global problems. So the neat thing about what we do is that it's both an opportunity for governments to save money and save lives. But we operate by signing commercial contracts with ministries of health, and we essentially are able to move much faster than cars and generally be cost competitive.
So what exactly would it cost to ship some blood to a patient that needs a transfusion?
It totally depends on the country where we're operating. But think about what it would cost to use a car to make a delivery somewhere, and that's about what it costs for us. So if it was going to cost you $30 to take a taxi somewhere, that's like the range of the price that we're charging.
And you're now looking to expand in Tanzania. My understanding is that you've signed a memorandum of understanding with the government, but you haven't yet sort of formalized that.
So we just signed a memorandum of understanding with the Tanzanian government to serve 10 million people using an instant delivery service that will take advantage of this technology in order to deliver a wide range of medical products on demand. It'll actually be the largest autonomous system anywhere in the world. In the long run, the opportunity of having an agile supply chain for healthcare is kind of like the holy grail in global public health. And it will make a really big difference in improving access, reducing waste, and also empowering doctors so that doctors who work in rural health facilities actually feel like their skills are utilized.
Kella Rinaldo there from Zipline. Well, the World Bank has also been using drones to survey land in Tanzania. Edward Anderson from the World Bank told Jane what he thinks of Zipline's plan.
It's something very compelling. There is a market for it, and I think their strategy to pursue commercial deals with governments is making it feel like something very real today and not a far-off science fiction activity. However, we should also say that no one quite knows what the cargo drone market in Tanzania is going to be. We really believe that in Africa it's going to develop quite differently to what you might see in the West. 75% of Tanzania's population lives more than 2 kilometers away from an all-weather road. And that means that on wet seasons, you know, the costs of goods, mobility, access to facilities is extremely limited for 3/4 of the population. So we can conceive of lots of different use cases. Some of them might be connecting excluded communities on islands, hard-to-reach areas, mountaintops, wet season services where you might collect samples. And that can be transformative for some of the surveillance programs, tuberculosis, HIV, malaria. Some services we could conceive would be a complement to the surface delivery. So you have heavy trucks from the medical supplies department does quarterly deliveries to something like 8,000 facilities in Tanzania. But these facilities will stock out, and they don't get the next delivery until the following quarter. So rather than sending an entire truck to supply these few stocked-out facilities, which is not economic, you could think of the drone as a top-up service.
You come with a drone. Would you like to tell us a little bit about the drone you've got here and what you see that being used for?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is not a cargo delivery drone. This is a mapping drone. It's a professional drone, but it looks, as you can see, quite small and simple. It's hand-launched, belly landing. We've started with drones like this because they're extremely safe to operate. It weighs less than a kilogram, but it's still a professional tool for photogrammetry. So we've been using them for flood risk assessment in urban areas, and the government got very excited by some of the photographic imagery and maps, so they've said, can we really apply it to land titles in peri-urban areas, which is really a problem in fast-growing, unplanned cities. So that was the next application in Dar es Salaam. And that scaled quite quickly to Zanzibar, where these have been used to recreate the national base map. Now, in Zanzibar, that's extremely important because they're trying to transition to this land economy where they want to give people titles, register their plots, allow people to invest or get mortgages. And without a proper title, that's really very difficult. So drones are accelerating that by making the digitization process quicker, cheaper, and providing much more detailed data.
Edward Anderson from the World Bank talking to our own Jane Wakefield over a cup of coffee by the sound of things. I wonder when the tech tent is going to get its own cafe. Anyway, moving on, let's have a quick chat. Tom Tamblyn, what's the most impressive use of a drone that you've seen, do you think?
So I think certainly in the last 12 months, one of the ideas that really stuck in my head was a project that was taking place at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden, in which a group of researchers were testing out essentially a defibrillator drone. So what they were doing was they were looking at the reaction times of ambulances to heart attacks and comparing those reaction times to how fast they could get a drone out. So they looked at the previous, I think, 600 instances, mapped them, and then timed their own drone against the ambulance and then compared them and found that it was actually pretty astonishing. So while the ambulance on average took around 22 minutes, the drone on average took about 5 minutes, which is, for me, I mean, it's a real step change.
Yeah, I mean, that's potentially life-saving, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the researchers, they think it could save hundreds of lives, easily if not thousands, if rolled out properly. Of course, one of the issues with a drone is range. So if you're talking about a heavy, large, congested city, the range is obviously going to be a problem, so they're going to need to overcome that. But the fact that the use case itself is sound, I think, is really exciting.
Thank you. Do you think, briefly, that, you know, we've kind of got so carried away in the negative side of drones, we've forgotten that actually they're pretty useful tools?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think looking at Zipline, and I remember last year there was an instance where UNICEF partnered with Malawi to start using drones to send off HIV results. I think this, combined with the commercial use of drones as well, so kind of helping farmers out, is really going to help change the image, because I think we do get a bit stuck in the negative kind of connotations with drones, and they really are actually really genuinely useful products.
Tom Tamblyn, thanks very much. Let's get a quick update now on the week's other top tech news. Marianne Rousson from the BBC online desk is here with me. So, Marianne, we've got Uber making headlines yet again this week. This time it's the announcement of a new chief exec. Do you think this could be the start of a new chapter after a very troubled 2017 so far?
Well, it could be. I mean, Dara Khosrowshahi has been confirmed as the new chief executive of this troubled app-based taxi company, and he takes over from Uber founder Travis Kalanick, who resigned amidst multiple scandals over the last couple of years. Mr. Khosrowshahi has a lot on his plate, though, to sort out. Amongst other things, he will need to address concerns over sexism and sexual harassment that linger despite the sacking of over 20 staff earlier this year. And he will also need to reassure both customers and drivers that Uber does respect their privacy amidst multiple scandals over Uber employees spying on user journeys and tracking users' phones 5 minutes after their journeys have ended.
And it's also been a big week for cybersecurity researchers following the discovery of an eye-wateringly gigantic spam bot.
Yes, it's really rather worrying. A security researcher has discovered that a spamming operation is using a list of over 711 million email addresses. The spam bot contains not just email addresses, but also some passwords. And its aim is to help spread the Ursniff banking malware by tricking people into clicking on email attachments. It would be a good idea for members of the public to check if their email accounts have been affected by going to the Have I Been Pwned website, and that's spelt haveibeenpwned.com. If so...
I can tell you that I have, just to interrupt. I had a quick look.
Me too, actually.
I'm one of a club of 711 million. How exclusive.
Me too. So if so... you might just possibly want to consider changing your password and also look at changing all of the passwords of the accounts on services that you use the most often.
Oh no, more things to remember. Okay, finally, now tell us why Amazon is the subject of legal action after August's solar eclipse.
So there's a couple in South Carolina who are claiming that they sustained some eye injuries during the solar eclipse because they were using defective eclipse glasses that they purchased from Amazon. Corey Payne and Kayla Harris have proposed a class action lawsuit after the glasses caused them to experience headaches and vision impairment. Amazon isn't commenting about the lawsuit, but it did say that it issued a recall via email to customers on certain potentially hazardous eclipse glass products on the 10th of August, which was about 11 days before the eclipse happened. However, Amazon hasn't said which products and vendors were affected, and the couple behind the lawsuit say that they never received any notice of the recall.
Marianne Roussan, many thanks. You're listening to Tech Tent on the BBC World Service. I'm Zoe Kleinman. Still to come, how data from your car will increasingly be gathered and traded. The holiday season is fast approaching, can you believe it? And you can bet the tech giants will be rubbing their hands at the thought of customers ready to splash their cash on new gadgets. The IFA Electronics Show opens today in Germany's capital, Berlin. It's the place to get a look at the stuff that will be in the shops in the next few months. Our reporter Joe Miller is there, and I spoke to him a short while ago.
Well, I'm standing actually in the middle of Sony's main hall here. It's gargantuan, and I'm surrounded by TVs that have new OLED screens. They seem to get bigger and sharper every year. And the pitch is very, very much at the Christmas market, at families. All of these TVs are showing the latest animated movies and trying to show how crisp and how clear they are. But the big star here today is a smart speaker, which comes with Google's Assistant. And it's very much a swipe at Apple's HomePod, because it's aggressively priced. It's about $200. And it's really the sort of thing that Sony is working towards these days. It's putting together its quite well-known hardware with software from other providers like Google. And that's really the biggest attraction here. People trying it out, trying to order things online, trying to make it play different music, which is quite hard in the noise of this big hall. But I must say, I tried it earlier myself, and it got 9 out of 10 things correct, so they've clearly tested it.
And LG is showing off a new smartphone that's moved away from its previous gimmicks, like the second screen. You had a hands-on with it, didn't you? What did you think of it?
This one is really a return to basics, the V30. It's got a very, very deep OLED screen. It's focused on taking pictures and shooting video. It's got a nice little zoom feature, which people are calling the Curb Your Enthusiasm zoom feature because of its similarity to the American TV show. And what it allows you to do is you can take a particular object or person in the distance and it'll zoom very nicely and smoothly towards that rather than towards the center of the image. It's quite a nice feature. I had a chat with Ken Hong. He's the Global Communications Director for LG, and he very much emphasized that LG wasn't going for the top spot. It really just wanted to offer an alternative for people who are sick of Apple and Samsung.
I think LG has always been about choice. It may not be number one in phones, it may not be the thinnest, the cheapest, the brightest. I mean, there's a lot of things that we are not. But one thing we have always been is giving people an alternative choice. Like, you don't want that phone, then look at an LG.
And finally, Jay, tell me about the kitchen scales that you don't want to put that big bar of chocolate on before you dive into it.
You certainly don't. I was quite astonished by this. It's a new scale by Terrayon, which is a French company, a scale company. And what it does is, using light, it can basically tell you the exact calorific content of any piece of raw food. So not processed food. I'm not sure it would do chocolate, but it definitely does, you know, fish and meat and vegetables and fruit. And I tried it out with pears and apples, and it tells you exactly how much water's in it, how many calories, how much sugar. And it's aimed at athletes and people who are on very, very strict diets. But I was slightly sceptical about whether we'd be living in a future where people would really get up in the morning and put, you know, all their food on a scale. So I put this to their R&D director, a man called Cédric Dubois.
We joke internally that we want to do the Shazam of the food, so we hope so that should be an habit that people will be used to that and will simplify their life. Yeah, sure.
Never underestimate the impact of the diet industry. Cédric Dubois there talking to Joe Miller. Now, Tom Tamblyn, you and I have escaped IFA because we're here and not there. But what's excited you about what's come out so far this week?
So, I mean, plenty's excited me. I mean, IFA never fails to disappoint when it comes to quirky products and concepts. And this year is absolutely no different. And something that really caught my attention was this, which is the Panasonic movable fridge and sake cooler. And what that is a voice activated remote controlled fridge that when you call it, beckon it, it will remove itself from the kitchen unit and simply rumble on over to your sofa and provide you with your cold beverage at any point. And what I love about this is that according to Panasonic, the fridge contains a complete database of almost every bottle of sake that you can think of, and then it will provide you with recommendations based on the food that you want to have it with.
Amazing. Is it fair to say that's probably quite a niche product?
Or I think
is there a mass market for sake that we don't
I
know
I think
about?
That is probably fair to say, and it's probably not going to be released, but at the same time, I don't mind because I think it looks great.
I'd love to see a fridge trundling towards me in my house. And very briefly, of course, we should mention the Sony smart speaker, which was also announced at IFA. What's going on with the smart speakers, do you think? Is there a race to sort of have the one that's going to be in all of our homes, or is there room for all of these models that we're seeing coming out?
I think generally what we're seeing is a very similar example of with smartphones, which is that we've got kind of three major, maybe four major operating systems or voice assistants. And then we're seeing large tech companies get behind one of them, but not all of them, maybe a couple of them. So what you're getting is you are getting fragmentation, but at the same time, you are getting choice. So we're seeing quite a large range of Alexa speakers, which bodes very well for Amazon. And we're seeing some Cortana speakers maybe in the future as well. So in that respect, I think it's good for us because it means we're going to get more choice. But there is also that kind of that worrying problem about fragmentation as well.
Tom, many thanks. Now, what is it, do you think, that is the most complex piece of electronics that you own? Is it your smartphone or maybe your laptop? Well, for many people, it's actually their car. According to the automotive tech giant Delphi, a typical car contains up to 50 small computers with over 100 million lines of computer code. And as cars become more automated, the amount of data they generate is set to rocket. In fact, there's already a nascent market for trading and making money from car data. Jack Gill spoke to David Parha, the president of Delphi Electronics and Safety.
When you think about data generated by the vehicle, that's going to grow exponentially. As autonomous driving develops, there's more and more sensors on the vehicle that generate a lot of data. This incredible amount of data cannot all, for economical reasons, be moved to the cloud. But we in Delphi have developed a platform, an end-to-end platform, that enables us to really discriminate in the vehicle the data that is valuable, move it to the cloud in a secure way, and then enable monetization by partnering with companies like Autonomo. It's an Israeli startup that actually have developed marketplaces or data brokering solutions to make the data available to companies such as insurance companies, retailers, or others that may want to have that data to monetize.
Okay, but if I'm generating that data through my driving my car, what's the payback for me? Should there be some kind of direct payback to me via micropayments if a retailer uses my data, or a discount for services, that kind of thing? What's your view on that?
Yeah, so the business models are being developed now and established. And obviously, when we think of making this possible, there's two aspects to it. One is, will the driver or the person in the vehicle provide access rights to his data? Obviously, in different geographies, there's different legislation for that. But in most of the cases, the driver will need to approve or accept that his data is being used. The second one is, what's their willingness to pay? I think you're raising a point. Maybe their expectation is that they get paid for it. But those business models are being tested. There's been surveys done and going on in terms of willingness to pay for certain things across the world. And what comes out is that not all the countries or not all the people are willing to pay the same for similar services. What we see as more valuable opportunities are those where clearly the data is delivering reduction of cost. So for example, if as a user, if by providing certain data to insurance companies, I get a reduction in my insurance premium, it's like getting paid for that, right? But in other cases, how maybe providing data to retail companies who know your location and can maybe offer discounts in that area, those are different types of business models where the different companies are trying to generate positive outcomes for the driver so that economically he's incentivized to share the data that he's generating.
David Paha there of Delphi. Tom, are you worried about the privacy aspects of this? Do you think the data about your location and your driving habits being traded by third parties?
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately we have to think of this next step is in many ways similar to smartphones, in the same way that it is simply a device that collects data and then we choose to accept how we share it. And I think that's the key there, which is privacy and transparency. So it's making sure that if we do share it, we're aware of what we're sharing, how we're sharing, and to whom we're sharing. Because we obviously have no issue sharing with third parties. We do it all the time with our smartphones. And it's making sure that as this is rolled out with cars, we're applying the same level of care to this different kind of data that will be used practically, I guess, in the same way as smartphones.
I mean, you say that we're used to it, but it does feel like a step further, doesn't it? Your driving habits feel somehow a bit private, don't they?
Yeah, it is a very personal thing, isn't it? But I think ultimately, as long as it translates into something that feels positive for us, so for example, a car letting your garage know that it needs fixing before actually something horrible happens to your car, or your insurance premiums going down, as long as it translates into something that is beneficial to us, I think it should be okay.
Thank you very much. That's all we've got time for. Once again, thank you to Marianne Rousson from the BBC Online Tech Desk. You can read her work and mine at bbc.com/technology. Thanks also to my special guest, Tom Tamblyn, tech editor of HuffPost UK. You can read his stuff over there. And thank you very much for listening. Rory is back next week in the Tech Tent. You can join him then.
Before you go, if you're enjoying Tech Tent, then allow me to recommend another offering from the BBC World Service. Just one question first. Do you eat? Well, if you answered yes, then this podcast is for you. The food chain is for farmers, foodies and fellow diners. Go to bbc.com/foodchain to find out more.